This week, we take a closer look at two publications looking to get beneath the surface of the modern world, one in the field of design, and another in a category all of its own. Plus, a check-in with our resident magazine connoisseur at Monocle's Kiosk Cafe. All that ahead of us here today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we're going to speak to the editors of two magazines, Icon and Yes and No, looking to bring fresh thinking to contemporary challenges. But we're going to begin by taking a brisk stroll round the corner and across the way from our studios here at Midori House to Monocle's Kiosk Cafe in Paddington. It's a magazine shop and cafe with a carefully curated selection of publications from all around the globe. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco was there earlier talking to the store's supervisor, Maverick Petit-Taylor.
Maverick, always a pleasure to see you here at the Kiosk Cafe. And today is quite a busy day. I think we don't have even seats to have our cinnamon bun. But tell us, how's it going at the Kiosk Cafe? How's since last time we spoke?
It just keeps getting busier and busier. It's very positive. People are being really receptive to all kinds of print. I'm finding recently people are really getting into the long form, which is very good timing for a recent release. Magazines like Foreign Affairs, Harvard Business Review, Berlin Quarterly, which is a nice long-form piece, they're all doing really well at the moment. So people are getting back into the proper solid reading.
And I noticed a few new titles. I mean, for example, you're starting to sell Vanity Fair as well, that shows the Kiosk Cafe is not all about the indie titles, but also, you know, strong consumer titles as well.
Yeah, of course. I think these magazines have just an integral part in the whole print scene as the indie titles. I find that these are a title like Vanity Fair is very, very popular. Everyone loves a bit of like celebrity gossip. Something like Vanity Fair does it so well, and it's mature.
And, you know, I love lists. Tell us, I mean, what's the bestseller or perhaps a magazine that sells well and you're perhaps a bit surprised by it?
Actually, I think I really like how Country Living's offshoot magazine, Modern Rustic, is doing really well. It's like a really chic take on all their best bits in their magazines. This is doing really well. I think it's one of our best interior magazines in terms of sales, definitely. What else? Of course, The Escapist. That has been very popular recently. But also some sports titles. For instance, Mundial, a really great football independent magazine, and Racket, which is a tennis magazine. They're doing really well. The sports, indie sports titles are doing really well, actually.
And of course, we are on the week of the launch of the Monocle Summer Weekly, and we have here, you know, quite a nice display of it. So was it a big interest? Because today, I believe, is the first day we're selling it,
yeah.
So.
Already, yeah, we've sold quite a few already, definitely. And we've got out on the front. We're letting people know about it. We've told a lot of people in the run-up, and people are getting excited about it, definitely. We've got even someone outside, I believe. He said he couldn't miss the launch, so he came specially for this.
Finally, Maverick, tell us about perhaps any future plans for the Kiosk Cafe, or are you looking for new titles as well? Do you go on a hunt for new titles sometimes?
We're constantly reviewing the list and you know, bringing in something or replacing something with maybe like a slightly different title. Maybe we'll try a bit more indie or a bit more commercial. But yeah, always on the hunt. So if you want to be stocked in the Kiosk Cafe, show me your magazine rather than email me your magazine.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to store manager Maverick Petit-Taylor at Monocle's Kiosk Cafe here in London. Setting out to strike an original note with a design magazine is often easier said than done. On this week's Stack, we are welcoming a magazine that always seems to get it right. Here in studio, we have Icon Magazine's editor James McLaughlin and the title's art director Carlo Apostoli.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you with us.
Hello, Tom.
And, I mean, we often ask people to bring a veritable stack of magazines with them. We've got, I don't know, more than a stack. There's stacks, plural. We've got magazines everywhere.
Yeah, we got a bit carried away.
You can never get carried away, James, when it comes to magazines. So we've got lots of different reference points. But let's maybe kick things off with Icon, because I've got a couple of recent copies. Well, you've raided the archives, I'm happy to say. Right back to issue one and a sort of a flavour through. Let me just ask you, with the sort of art director's eye, first of all, when you look through, what are we talking, kind of 14, 15 years worth, I guess, something around
15
that.
15 years ago, at least.
What do you think? Can you sort of see a crazy biographical story being told?
You can see some craziness, I think, in those early issues. Yeah.
Well, we can definitely see that and say that it was a completely different world in every aspect of magazine making. Mm. Because, of course, the format is larger, way larger. Pagination is just, I don't know, triple maybe. And visual language is completely different. So not only in an icon perspective, like in general, you can see how different was the approach of designers to editorial design, like so bombastic, and like people were very excited about, you know, like, oh, I can do this with a computer, you know? And now we
it
are
was so, the early noughties, it was a crazy
yeah,
time.
Yeah, right? It really was.
And
yeah.
Now we are sort of limiting ourselves, and sort of the approach, the communication approach, is much more defined and sleek in a way. You know, it's more precise. And these were like sort of crazy times. But also, I think there is also for us and a pleasure in looking through these pages.
Well, and James, on that point, you know, I guess the editor is, you know, ultimately tasked with delivery of that vision. Mm. How important is it though to keep half an eye on the heritage, even if maybe there were eras that don't sit as comfortably with your perspective or however you want to describe it? There's still a sort of a lineage to trace through. Do you often find yourself kind of glancing back?
I do, yeah. And it's interesting because those early issues, as Carla said, they were so exuberant and so experimental. I mean, you know, text on pictures, and they didn't worry about legibility so much. There was just a sort of explosion of ideas and really the sort of appetite to let it all hang out. And I think when it launched, it was so exciting as a publication. It kind of, there wasn't a lot else around, I have to say. And they came along and kind of really shook things up a bit. So it's a heritage that Carlo and I have been sort of, you know, we have half an eye on, and we do sort of acknowledge.
I just wondered on that design point, Carlo, about particularly the idea of doing great work, but maybe with a slightly tighter budget. Sometimes can that, I mean, it's easy to see it as a restriction, but can it be quite good, actually, for the creative to have, you know, not such profound resources? Does some of the best work come when maybe you're under a bit of pressure to deliver?
In a way, yes. If we can find a bright side of the, you know, operating under difficult circumstances. And I mean, every publication, even the biggest, have budget issues. I never met anyone that said, like, oh, we have big budgets.
They don't tend to stay around very long.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that, yeah, having some limits, it's good. And I think, when we talk about also the old icon, like bombastic, but yes, maybe that attitude is also past now in a way. But I think what with James, what's happening now, I think we are sort of maintaining the same enthusiasm for that product. And so if there is something that we take from it, is sort of the attitude we put into it. Mm. But of course, the language is completely different. And the budget and the constrictions, the less paginations and everything, yes, it makes us a little bit smarter, I guess. And when we do something, it's like neat. But also it makes us focus a little bit, even as designers, I think, on the core aspect of icon. And to be honest, it's not just about design or the imagery. It's really about the stories and the reporting and the quality of the writing. So, yes, I like great paper. I like big formats. I like great photography. But there is more about it. And I think the core of the magazine is in its stories. And we don't necessarily need big budget to deliver that.
Mm. Exactly, so, to tell a great story. James, on that point, it's interesting because I guess particularly in this, especially in that slightly more trade space, there's so many easy ways for great practices, great projects to reach a relatively large number of people. You know, they can go to some of these websites which offer massive, quick reads, many millions of eyes. Mm-hmm. Is it much more difficult than it has ever been, perhaps, to ensure that you still get great stories? Can you find architectural practice, for example, or a new building project where they say, look, we really want you guys to tell the story because you've got that storytelling craft, exactly what Carlo's talking about there. You've got something extra than just you know, you can guarantee us a number of page views or whatever.
That's true. It's worked in our favour, I suppose, that we have a rule. We don't write about a building that we've never visited, you know, so it's never going to be a turnaround of a press release and just calling in some images. So I think that immediately sets you apart from a lot of internet sites, because that really is the name of the game. You know, traffic hits, you know, as much content as you can upload as possible. First of all, we don't have the resources to do that kind of thing. We're a monthly magazine. We do have a website, but mainly it's the focus is on the monthly magazine. Because we're quite careful about who we commission to write for us, our writers do generally bring with them stories that have not been sort of pushed out towards blogs or internet sites. I can think of one recently, a project in China, a mountaintop village that we had the sort of, it was us, and then I think Wired had something after us, but it was a sort of a world exclusive for a small, oh, there it is, for a sort of niche architecture and design title. That showed, you know, if you do try and concentrate on the quality of content and try and critique something, it wasn't, you know, overwhelmingly a positive story about the project. It was a measured kind of analysis of it.
And what goes into that? I mean, is that writers with a great Rolodex, or is it a bit of serendipity? Sometimes, you know, a bit of luck.
Yeah, I mean,
that
some of
often
it is both.
Makes the great
yeah.
stories, right?
And then
yeah.
sometimes it's the architects themselves will come to you and say, would love you to write something about our project. You're our favourite magazine. They're not really interested in punting it out to the internet, not just kind of get the press kit and then just whack it online. Just actually engage with it, visit it, walk around it, well, talk to the architect.
This I always find one of the great ironies, because people always talk about engagement in that online capacity, and actually to really engage with something. And I think it's funny you say that about architects coming to you, because, I mean, Carla, presumably you'd go along with this. I mean, I don't know if this happens often, but they must say, you know, you've presented this project, you've captured the essence of this building in words and in the way that the page is laid out and the images in a way that truly does it justice. I mean, that's more engaging in the true sense of the word, isn't it, than looking at it on your iPhone on the tube in the morning?
I suspect yes. I mean, I got some compliments, so I guess...
I'm allowed to be nice to people.
Yeah. Yes, but this is also the case. No matter what, I think Icon, for example, it deals with topics and matters that are universal and interesting for everybody, but at the same time, you know, it's a niche publication, and I, you know, like a big niche, but it's still a niche, especially for this kind of stories, not like content, but stories. Yeah, you need that extra effort and extra space and time. Of course, I'm addicted to my iPhone and everything, but you just simply don't get that anywhere else except in an environment that sort of takes the enough time to go through everything, fact check.
I think that's another thing that we should probably talk about, is that Icon has retained its critical teeth in some way that I know is harder and harder to do, particularly with commercial concerns and advertising. I mean, it is hard to maintain some kind of independence, but that, I think, you sort of live and die on that.
That's often one of the most tempting corners to cut, isn't it?
Well,
because of these constraints that you're describing, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some newsstand inspiration. Do you look for new titles on the newsstand? Do you have perennials that you always come back to? Do you read other architectural design magazines as rivals, or do you read them as an enthusiast of
publishing? Well, of course
publishing?
There aren't any, Tom.
But what's that process like? And maybe you could mention a couple of the titles you brought in as well.
What have I brought today? It's been a bit of a sort of... one of them I brought because I used to work on it, and I still have quite a soft spot for it, and it is the Architects Journal, which has got 125-year history, I think it's been going as a up until about a year ago, I think, a weekly title. There was a really strong news desk, and it was a real machine, and that actually so useful if you are an architect practicing in Great Britain. It will tell you everything really you need to know.
Carla, what about you? I mean, obviously, can you look at things purely with your sort of design hat on when you look at the newsstand? You just scan things that are pleasing to you, or again, is it always a critical exercise? Why have they done this? Oh, I wish I'd thought of that.
Yeah, there's very few magazines that I would say I don't like. You know,
okay.
Like I'm interested in.
You're an enthusiast, Carla.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really like the industry. Like, it's an horrible industry, let's face it. But
speak for yourself, Carla, please.
Well, it's not pretty out there sometimes, you know. Sometimes it's struggling business and everything. But still, I like journalism, especially. So I have a huge fascination for journalists and stories and all the little bits, sub-editors and everything. Like, I really like the whole thing. Okay, so every magazine maybe can provide some inspiration or everything. But for Icon, for example, for me, the main issue is that I would like it to be, I don't see it as a, I don't know, it's independent in spirit, but it's still, you know, it's a business that, you know, like it pays at least 10 people full time. So it's not a hobby or, so I try to balance that. And so I try to make it accessible and at the same time, as neat as possible and as sleek as possible. So that's a difficult balance to achieve, I think, because we don't have the luxury, for example, of other independent titles that are inspiration for me, okay? But, you know, like you can do big picture, two columns of text for 24 pages, you know? You know, the one of the main issues we have is like, oh, we have 4 pages for these stories, and they are all singles. So
but this is where the creativity comes from. It goes back to what we talked about earlier. But so let's delve into your stack of magazines. I see you've got an Esquire here.
So I would say
Bloomberg Businessweek, a couple of sort of perennials which often crop up. What is it about your selection? What do some of these titles say to you?
I was going through my stuff at home. I found I got a copy of Bloomberg Businessweek of May 2013. So it's in full Richard Turley's tenure, and I would say that's massively influential to me in a way, because it's, as we were saying, it's maybe one of the best ways in the last 10 years or something to sort of put together a free approach, freedom and fun into layouts, and at the same time being really informative and really respectful for the reader, for the stories. So it's just a big pleasure to go through, but it's also very easy to read. It's not like... design doesn't come first in a way, but it plays a huge role in it. So and that was for me also sort of a game changer personally. Like I was buying it and sort of trying to steal things from it. You know?
Do you mean pay tribute to it?
Pay tribute. Yeah. Of course.
Less of a steal.
You know, but you know, if you see some arrows going around in my layouts, maybe that's because of Richard Turley.
A good idea is still a good idea, and wherever it came from. I mean, it's funny actually. We're talking, James, about this idea, and it often seems to be the balance of different challenges and pressures and freedoms. Mm. What about some of the other things? I think, you got The Spectator. I mean, is it always a question of balancing, whether it's sober coverage with levity or bold graphics with something that's more consumable and durable and has more popular? Is it always a balancing act in all these different respects, do you think?
I do think that helps. I mean, you can't be just, you can't cosh your reader over the head constantly with another in-depth feature. So we do have a gossipy column. We have things like Crimes Against Design, which is always just a broadside, completely unfair sometimes, but, you know. So we do have the space for that, and I think that helps with a rhythm and a kind of, and an identity. Often your identity comes from some of these small, almost frivolous pieces that give you a bit more of a kind of display, a bit of cavalier spirit, and that can help engage with people. I've used that word engage. I'm so sorry.
No, it's good. I think it's relevant in one way or the other. We always seem to come back to it. Tell me a little bit then, gents, about, so I guess September's on newsstand. October is kind of going to bed soonish. What sort of things do the Icon readers have to look forward to? What's been informing your thoughts of late?
I suppose the thing on the horizon for Icon is quite a funny beast in some ways, because it's almost to borrow a sort of Jimmy Greavesy, it's a game of two halves. We have an architecture focus and a design focus, and you'd be surprised how little those two worlds really sort of ever meet each other. But the main focus for the next issue is a London Design Festival, which is just around the corner, coming up mid to late September. So outside of Milan, I suppose this is the kind of the big design fair and festival for our readers. So there's going to be sort of a few preview pieces in that issue. We've got a cover by someone who's going to be quite a big participant. We've asked them to sort of design our cover, so it's kind of a bit of bespoke artwork that hopefully is Carlo's going to put the finishing touches on, and it's going to sing like
we'll
an
see
angel.
About that.
Then we've got a real sort of mixed bag. Kind of, I mean, I was trying to get a handle on this issue, and it feels like a bit of a kind of gorgeous mess. I think everything, it seems to be kind of, I don't know, there's something interesting about everything in it, so particularly some of the longer features, which have actually proved some of the most challenging, I think, for the art desk. It's not as if we've come with these story ideas, and they're still about to go on page, and it's how Carlo is going to illustrate something that's quite abstract or quite oblique, a serious story, but not as simple as just doing some photo reportage and that is telling you the story. You've had to be a lot more lateral in this issue, and I think it's going to be all the better for it.
Thanks for coming to share your vision for ICON with us today. Thanks.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Finally, on today's programme, we turn our attention to Yes and No. It's a quarterly magazine on its second issue, setting out to defy categorisation and address the modern world in the fullness of its complexity. It is delightfully eclectic, with articles on blood-borne pathogens by NHS medics sitting alongside avant-garde fiction and seasonal recipes. A little earlier, Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan spoke to founder and editor Cassius Matias, who began by talking about his background as a filmmaker.
I started at St Martin's. Before St Martin's, I was at the London College of Communication, which at that time was called LCP. So I trained to be a printer. And then I sort of, in a very sort of roundabout way, I kind of got into St Martin's as a painter and then spent a year in the painting department. Halfway through the painting department, I had a road accident. I was run over by a double-decker bus. So this meant that I took a year out. And in that period, I decided to change my course and turn to filmmaking. So I devoted my life to films and filmmaking. And that's how I got into the film business, is basically graduating as a filmmaker from St Martin's.
At what point in your career did the idea for Yes and No come to you, and why?
The idea came to me 2 years ago, and it took 18 months from idea to newsstand. The reason being was I was convalescing from an illness. And during that period, I thought, let me create a magazine that I want to read. Because even though there are lots of great magazines out there, there wasn't really anything that I wanted to read. I mean, there are lots of things that I was interested in, but sort of I wanted a magazine, in fact, like Yes and No. So I thought if I could create Yes and No, if it could appeal to me and my sensibility, then there might be other people who would also be into it.
Tell me about Yes and No and its agenda. And you mentioned that the idea kind of came to you perhaps out of a sense of dissatisfaction with what magazines were on offer at the time.
The negative thing about Yes and No is that it's not just about one thing. It's about many things. So if you're looking for a magazine that is just about this or just about that, then probably Yes and No magazine isn't for you. The thing that I didn't really like about most other magazines is that they are normally about just one thing. So you have, you know, a music magazine, a fashion magazine. I wanted a magazine that sort of showed me a whole range of stories and topics that I may or may not be aware of, that I could discover. So that was the kind of thinking behind Yes and No.
I think one of the most impressive aspects of the magazine, for me, there's a lot of magazines out there with striking imagery, really good photography, really well designed, strong writers. There are fewer who feel the confidence to be able to tackle scientific topics head on alongside topics that are normally categorised under the banner of the humanities. Mm-hmm. But you don't shy away from that. There are two scientific features that I've noticed in the two issues you've published so far. Mm-hmm. One is an extraordinary series on blood-borne viruses written by an NHS doctor. Mm-hmm. And the other, and it's the cover story, if you could call it that, of the latest issue, is about airborne pollution. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to take on scientific topics? And then maybe you can tell me in a little bit more detail about the two stories you've commissioned so far.
Well, for me, I think the world we're living in is a world where concepts are colliding. We're living in a world where, almost like a decompartmentalized world, where we don't have set categories as we used to have in the 20th century. I think things can be scientific and also artistic at the same time, and things can be artistic and scientific. And I think there's a way of actually saying that this is the yes and no-ness, if you like, of the magazine. It's bringing apparent opposites into one form, which is the magazine. So when I thought about the kind of segments of the magazine, I knew that I wanted a health section, but I didn't want to talk about going to the gym. I didn't want to talk necessarily about eating healthy food, quote unquote. I just wanted to talk about real health issues that affect everyone, but yet at the same time that everyone isn't necessarily aware of. So bloodborne viruses was an obvious choice.
And it's written by Dr. Laura Waters, who is a medical consultant at the Central and Northwest London NHS Trust. Mm-hmm. How did you get her on board? Because it's not, I suppose, a qualified medical doctor isn't necessarily a stereotypical contributor to a magazine.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the same way that Professor Frank Kelly isn't a stereotypical contributor either. He's the one that the subject, really, of the cover story for the second issue.
Which is about airborne pollution.
Exactly.
How do you approach these people?
Just by doing research, finding out who I need to talk to, who are the people who are the experts in these fields, and really sort of presenting them with an idea to say, look, this is what I'm doing. What do you think? I want to appeal to a broad audience, although I want to appeal to a broad audience in a very different kind of way, to make these ideas that seem perhaps hackneyed or kind of scary, to make them seem human and relatable.
I want to talk a little bit about the boring logistical side mm-hmm. of coming up with an interesting magazine. You're willfully trying to break down categories. Mm-hmm. I found your magazine in Barnes & Noble in New York, and I've forgotten where it was shelved in that particular store. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, there comes a point in the production of a magazine where you actually have to distribute it, come up with an agreement with stores as to where they're going to place it, mm-hmm. what magazine it's going to be put next to. How did you hash that granular stuff out?
Well, I had the same problem, actually, with the demographic. So people ask me about, you know, who is the demographic? And even though I'm aware of the kind of demographics that marketing people talk about, I wanted to kind of move away from those kind of conventions. I think in the 21st century, I think we can think about things very differently than we used to in the 20th century. With Yes and No in Barnes & Noble, we're in special interest department.
Right. Alongside kind of Aircraft Weekly and what? Is that where you're going to find you? Or?
Well, I haven't actually seen the setup in Barnes & Noble, but we're in 146 Barnes & Noble outlets.
Okay.
I didn't really sort of think about where this magazine is going to sit on the shelf, whether it was going to be in the art section, in the cultural lifestyle. I just thought that let me just create the magazine from the inside out. Let it define what it wants to be. Let it decide where it wants to sit on the shelf. It can take center shelf, as it were, but it can also be at the side. It's a magazine that is kind of like versatile, which I hope is demonstrated by the two cover stories that we have in the first two issues. A well-known person, in the one hand, for issue one, Sam Taylor Johnson, a concern that was basically affecting everyone that lives in a city, air pollution, on the other hand, for issue two.
Perhaps you can tell me about some of the publications, writers, maybe even films that have influenced you putting together Yes and No.
Well, because of my filmmaking background, it's a very interesting question. I approach the whole creation of the magazine as I would create a movie. So for me, it was a cinematic project. So there's no particular filmmaker or particular film that I could point to say I wanted to make a Fellini magazine or a Kubrick magazine, but I wanted to make a magazine that has scale and that has that sort of vision, that sort of cinematic vision. But I'm also influenced by the contributors and inspired by them, their stories, their personalities, the artists that I work with in the creation of the magazine, the designers at Pentagram, Jeremy Koons, the printers. Everyone has come together to create this. It's not just like a sort of a one-man show. It's an ensemble in the same way that a film is made by a group. And this is how I'm approaching the magazine.
Cassius Matias, editor of Yes and No magazine, speaking to Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan. Issue 2 of Yes and No is on newsstands now. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rees Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Any comments or queries are welcome as always. Drop Fernando a note. He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. You can follow in Fernando's footsteps and head to Kiosk Cafe, our own newsstand in Paddington. You can find all the details, of course, on our website. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.